Blush. Excuse me? You've got a choice too, and you keep choosing to stay right here.
Because I'm afraid, Cal. I try to snarl, but it comes out like a whisper. That stills him, just a little. A cool compress over a fresh burn.
So am I,
he says, his voice echoing the pain in mine. Without thinking, I say what I really mean. I miss her, he responds in kind.
So do I.
We're talking about two different people, but the sentiment is the same. He looks down at his hands as if ashamed of the love he feels for someone he cannot have. I know what that agony is like, what an anchor it is, how it will eventually drown us both. If I tell you something, will you promise to keep it a secret? I murmur. Like him, I lean forward until I could take his hands if I wanted. Even from Julian and Annabelle, especially from them. Cal glances up again. He searches my eyes, looking for the trick in me, waiting for whatever Salmo's trap he thinks I'm about to spring.
Yes.
I lick my lips and speak before my brain can tell me to stop. I think they're going to kill my father. He blinks, confused.
That doesn't make any sense.
Well, they won't do it, but... For the first time in my life, I take Tiberius Calor's hand and do not hate the sensation. I grip his fingers tightly, trying to make him understand. Do you really think Senra and Iris would trade Maven for someone like Solon Eral?
No, I don't.
Cal breathes. He squeezes my hand, his grasp stronger than mine.
And with your father dead?
I nod as he follows my train of thought. The rift dies with him, returns to Norda, I say. Ptolemus won't have the spine to fight a war with father dead. No matter how good he is at fighting, he isn't meant for it.
I find that hard to believe.
Cal scoffs, his tone changing. Then his eyes shift, brows knitting together, before releasing like a weight cut loose. Realization washes over him.
You haven't told your parents this, have you?
I shake my head. His mouth hangs open.
Evangeline, if you're right,
I'm going to let him die. I know. I hiss to myself, at myself. I snatch my hand away, unable to touch or look at him. Fuming, I stare at the carpeted floor, tracing the fine patterns of red-made artistry. You've always thought me terrible. Is it nice to know you're right? His fingers are hot beneath my chin, tipping my face up to look at him.
Evangeline,
he murmurs. But I don't want his pity. I push him away. I hope the gods of Iris Signet aren't real. I can't imagine what punishments they have in store for me. Cal rests his mouth against his knuckles, idly running his hand back and forth over his lips. Eyes far away, he nods in agreement.
For all of us.
28. Iris. Citadel of the Lakes is the safest place I could ever be, and yet I'm on edge, nervous, constantly looking over my shoulder. I see only familiar guards in their blues, almost blending into the mist of a rainy summer morning. Jadansa is here too, the old Telki trailing my mother and me as we walk the pathways arching over the vast training grounds. She has a calming presence, much like my mother, and I try to relax with them so close. Below us, regiments of the Lakelander army prepare for war. Those who have already fought, legions ceded to Maven while we were allied, have earned some well-needed rest. The soldiers here are fresh, ready to fight, eager to win a country for the glory of the Lakelands. The hills and rivers, the beaches of Norda, their powerful tech towns, bursting with electricity and economic value. The kingdom of Norda is a gold mine just waiting to be claimed. Thousands upon thousands of soldiers drill in the rain, unbothered by the wet weather. The same will be true across our kingdom. From Citadel of the Snows to Citadel of the Rivers, the call has gone out. We are mobilizing all we can gather, silver and red. The army of the Lakelands is assembled and ready to strike. We have the numbers, we have the abilities. Our enemy is already crippled, and we need only put it out of its misery. So why do I feel so unsettled, deep in my heart? Reviewing troops doesn't require royal finery, and both of us are dressed like the soldiers we support, in blue uniforms edged with glinting silver and gold. Even Mother has stopped wearing her mourning blacks. But we haven't forgotten Father, or our vengeance. It weighs on us all like a heavy stone. I feel it with every step. We cross the last bridge, stepping onto one of the many balconies ringing the central structure of the citadel. The windows glow, beckoning with warmth. Despite the calming effect of the rain, I'm eager to get out of the weather. My mother moves quickly, setting our pace, and leads us inside. We're supposed to meet Tiora for lunch, but by the time we reach the room prepared for our meal, she still isn't there. It isn't like my sister to be late. I glance at my mother for some kind of explanation, but she merely takes her seat at the head of the table. If Queen Senra isn't bothered by Tiora's absence, then I won't be either. Like Mother, I take my seat, ready to wait for Tiora to arrive. The guards hang back at the door, taking up flanking positions, but Judansa sits. She is a noble of the Meren line, an ancient and distinguished family here in the Lakelands, and she has served us for many years. While the queen helps herself to some fluffy bread, I inspect the vast array of silverware, forks, spoons, knives especially. I count the possible weapons on the table out of habit, careful to include the filled water glasses, more deadly than any knife in my hands. I stare at the water, letting it fill my perception as it fills each glass. The sense is as familiar as my own face, but somehow different now, after what I helped my mother do. It's been days since we made our trade, and I can't get it out of my head. The sound especially. How the Iral lord choked on his last breaths, unable to fight us off. The Kalor king's uncle, someone named Jacos, is a singer, and he removed any fight from the man before we could get our hands on him. Maybe if he could have fought back, I wouldn't feel so strange. He deserved to die, deserved worse punishment than we gave. But the memory still fills me with a strange, foreign sense of shame, as if I have betrayed the gods in some way, gone against their will and their nature. I'll pray some more tonight, and hope to find an answer in their wisdom. Eat. Before the food gets cold, Mother says, gesturing to the plates before us. Tiora will be with us in a moment. I nod and move mechanically, serving myself. Precautions have to be taken. No red servants, not while we discuss the path ahead. The Scarlet Guard has ears and eyes everywhere. We must be vigilant. Most of the meal is fish, butterflied trout, sliced open and fried with butter and lemon, yellow perch, crusted with pepper and salt, a warming stew of lamprey eel, the heads removed and proudly displayed at the center of the table. Their rows of spiraling teeth gleam in the soft light of the dining room. The other plates hold ears of golden corn, greens tossed in spiced oil, braided breads. The usual bounty from Lakelander crops. Our farms are far-flung and prosperous, able to feed our country twice over. Lakelanders never want for food, not even the lowest red. I help myself to a little of each, careful to leave the lamprey for Tiora. It's an acquired taste, not to mention her favorite. Another minute goes by in silence, marked only by the kindly ticking of a clock on the wall. Outside, the rain picks up, lashing the windows in merciless sheets. "The army should break until this clears," I mutter. No use letting our soldiers get sick and feed an epidemic of colds. True, Mother replies around bites of food. She tips a hand at Judansa, who stands quickly. She ducks into a curt bow. I'll make it so, Your Majesty, she says before setting off to deliver the order. The rest of you, wait outside, my mother continues, glancing at each of our guards in turn. They don't hesitate, almost leaping to follow her commands. I watch the room empty, my nerves prickling. Whatever Mother wants to say to me isn't meant for an audience. When the door shuts again, leaving us alone, she steeples her fingers together and leans forward. It isn't the rain that bothers you, mon amour. For a second, I debate denying it, pasting on a smile, forcing a laugh and a dismissal. But I don't like to wear masks with my mother. It's dishonest. And besides, she sees right through them. I sigh, setting aside my fork. I keep seeing his face. She softens, wavering from queen to mother. I miss your father, too. No! The word stumbles out, too quick, startling my mother. Her eyes widen a little, darker than usual in the dim light. I do think about him all the time, but... I search for the proper way to say this. Instead, I put it bluntly. I'm talking about the man who killed him. Who we then killed, Mother says, her voice even. It isn't an accusation, but a simple statement of fact. At your suggestion. Once more, I feel rare shame. A flush creeps over my cheeks. Yes, it was my idea to take up Queen Annabelle's offer, to trade Maven for the man who killed my father, and later on the man he killed my father for. But that part of the bargain has yet to be paid. I do it again, I mutter, playing with my food for some distraction. I feel exposed beneath my mother's gaze. He deserves to die 100 times, but... She tightens, as if in pain. You've killed before, in defense of your own life. I open my mouth to try to explain, only to find her still speaking. But not like that, she adds, laying one hand on mine. Her eyes shine, full of understanding. No, I admit, bitter and disappointed in myself. This was a righteous kill, payment for the death of my father. It shouldn't be this way. Mother's fingers grip mine. Of course it would feel different, feel wrong somehow. My breath catches in my throat as I stare at our joined hands. Will it go away? I murmur, forcing myself to look back up at her. But Mother isn't looking at me. She glances out the window into the obscuring rain. Her eyes dance with the lashing water. How many people has she killed, I wonder? I have no way of knowing and no way of finding out. Sometimes, she finally says. Sometimes not. Before I can tug on that thread to unravel exactly what she means, Teora enters the room, her own guards left behind in the hallway, like ours. While Mother came to Norta briefly, against all traditions of the Lakelands, Teora stayed behind to keep our nation's borders safe, and our armies ready for the next step in our journey. She was well suited to the job, and it seems to cheer her, even as we leap between wars. The heiress to the Lakelander throne looks just like another soldier, her uniform wrinkled, without any livery or insignia to it. She could be a simple messenger, if not for the signet look, high cheekbones, and a higher opinion of oneself. She sits with our father's grace, folding her long limbs into the chair across from mine. Lovely, I'm famished, she says, picking at the spread with both hands. I nudge the stew in her direction, along with the display of lamprey heads. As children, we used to throw them at each other. Teora remembers, and she offers a tiny grin in reply. Then she gets down to business, facing our mother with the gravity of a general. We have word from snows, hills, trees, rivers, and plains, she says, rattling off the other citadels dotting the vast expanse of the Lakelands. All are ready. Queen Senra nods, pleased by the news. As they should be. The time to strike is coming, and coming soon. The time to strike. We've spoken of nothing else since I returned to my homeland. I haven't even had time to enjoy my freedom beyond the bounds of Maven's kingdom or his marriage. Mother has me in endless meetings and reviews. After all, I'm the only one of us to have faced Tiberius and his contingent of unknown Red soldiers, not to mention his Rift allies. We have Bracken and Piedmont on our side, yes. But is he a better ally than Maven was? A better shield against the Kalor brother now on the throne? Is it even any use to wonder? Our decision is long since made. Maven is a card we've already played and traded off. Tira forges on. More importantly, it seems Tiberius Kalor's newly made kingdom is splintering again. I blink at her, forgetting the food on my plate. How so? The Reds are no longer with them, she replies. I feel myself twitch in surprise. According to our intelligence reports, the Scarlet Guard, that strange new blood, and the Montfort armies have all disappeared. Returned to the mountains, we think, or gone underground. At the head of the table, Mother sighs aloud. She raises one hand, massaging her temple. When is anyone going to learn that young kings are fools? Tiora smirks in amusement, enjoying Mother's show of female frustration. I'm more interested in the implication of Red desertion. Without Montfort, the New Bloods, the spies of the Scarlet Guard, without Mayor Barrow, the scales have certainly tipped against Tiberius Kalor. And it isn't difficult to understand why. The Reds won't support him on the throne, I say. I didn't know Mare well, but I saw enough of her to guess. She fought Maven at every turn, even as a prisoner. Surely she wouldn't stomach another king. They must have had an agreement, to win the country back and build anew. Tiberius refused his end of the bargain. Silver is still rule in Norsa. After a bite of lamprey, Tiora shakes her head. Not entirely. There have been proclamations, more rights for the Reds of Norda, better wages, the end of forced labor. They've stopped conscription, too. My eyes widen, mostly out of shock, but also from unease. If Reds across the border are offered such boons, what will happen to Reds in the Lakelands? It will be an exodus, a mad dash. We have to close our borders, I say quickly. Stop any Reds from crossing into Norta. Again, Mother sighs. He's truly an idiot, she mutters. Of course, we'll double our watch at the Norton border. Leave it to a Kalor to cause us more headaches. Tiora hums low in her throat. He's causing himself headaches as well. Their tech towns are draining as we speak. I assume any economic might they have now will soon follow. At that, our mother almost laughs to herself. I would join her if I could. All I can think about is the magnificent stupidity of Tiberius Kalor. He's only just won back his throne, and now he seeks to strip his country of its greatest strengths? For who? Some red-blooded nobodies? For the myth of equality, justice, honor, or whatever other foolish ideal he hopes to achieve? I scoff to myself. I wonder if the Kalor king, left to his own devices, will simply drown under the weight of his crown. Or be devoured by the Rift King, scheming to leech what he can from the so-called Flame of the North. He won't be the only silver in the Norton territories to chafe under the proclamations. I feel a smirk curl on my lips, twisting to one side as I think. I doubt the silvers of Norta will like that, I say, waving a finger over my water glass. Inside, the liquid swirls with my motions. Mother eyes me, trying to follow my train of thought. Indeed. I could reach out to a few of them, I continue, the plan coming as quickly as I speak it. Offer condolences, or incentives. If some could be swayed, just a few key regions, Mother says, seeming to light up. I nod. Then this war will be over in a single battle. Archaon falls, and Norta with it. Across from me, Tiora pushes her favored stew away. What about the Reds? I gesture to her with an open hand. You said it yourself. They've gone to ground, retreated, left Norta open for the taking. Grinning, I glance between my mother and sister. All thoughts of the Iral Lord and his death seem to evaporate from my mind. We have more important things to worry about. And we have to take it. For the gods, Teora breathes, gently hitting her fist against the table. I stifle the urge to correct her. Instead, I dip my head to my older sister. For our own protection. She blinks, confused. Our protection? We sit here, serving our own lunch, for fear of the Scarlet Guard. Reds surround us, in our nation and outside it. If their rebellion continues to spread, hungry as a cancer, where will that leave us? I brush my fingers over the plates and cups, then gesture to the empty room and windows. The rain has lessened, easing to a steady pattern of drips. In the distance, to the west, the sun breaks through the gray clouds in tiny spatters of light. And what about Montfort? An entire country of Reds and those strange new bloods set against us? We have to defend ourselves, make ourselves too big and too strong to challenge. Neither of you has been there. You haven't seen their city, high in the mountains, red and silver and new blood joined together, and stronger for the joining. It was easy to sneak into Ascendant to rescue Bracken's children, but I can't imagine an army doing the same. Any war with Montfort will be bloody for both sides. It must be prevented, made impossible, before it can even begin. I steel myself. Give them no chance to rise up or stand against us. Mother is quick to respond. Agreed. Agreed. Teora offers with the same speed. She even raises her glass, the clear liquid turning in the faceted cup. Outside, as the rain ebbs to nothing, I feel a bit calmer. Still anxious about what is to come, but satisfied by the plan taking shape. If Maven's houses can be made loyal to us, then Tiberius will be severely hobbled, losing allies left and right. Alone on the throne is no place for anyone to be. Maven was alone too, no matter how many advisors and nobles surrounded him. I'm glad he never tried to make me share his empty hours, at least not more than was necessary. He frightened me when he was alive. He was an impossible person to predict. I never knew what he might say or do, and it forced me to live on edge. I've only just begun to catch up on all the sleep lost in his palace, too close to the monstrous king for comfort. I'm surprised they didn't execute him publicly, I muse aloud, my voice low. I wonder how they did it. I see Maven in my head, struggling weakly against our guards. He didn't see it coming. I'm impossible to predict, too. My sister dips her spoon in the lamprey stew, not eating, but pushing the liquid back and forth. It sloshes, filling the silence. What is it, Teora? Mother prods, seeing right through her display. Teora hesitates, but not for long. There's been some speculation about that, she says. He hasn't been seen or heard from since he was taken to the palace in Harbor Bay. I shrug. Because he's dead. Teora doesn't look at me. Can't look at me. Our spies don't think so. Despite the warmth of the room and the food, I feel a sudden chill deep in my chest. I swallow hard, trying to understand, and ignore the fear threatening to return. Don't be a coward. He's far away, imprisoned if not dead. He's not your problem anymore. My mother shares none of my terror. She just blusters. Why keep him alive? I swear, these Kalor brothers are trying to out-idiot each other. I try to be more thoughtful. I speak if only to mask my unease. Perhaps the older brother can't do it. He seemed soft-hearted. He must be, to allow himself to be so manipulated by a red girl. Teora is just as observant as our mother, and she tries to be gentle as she explains. There are rumors that Maven isn't there anymore. The Queen of the Lakelands blanches. Well, where could he be? There are few options, and I run through them quickly. Of course, one is more obvious than the rest, and woefully awful for that lightning girl. At least I escaped to Maven Kalor. She, it seems, cannot. I suspect Montfort, I say. He's with the New Bloods and the Scarlet Guard. With Mayor Barrow. Tiara bobs her head, thinking as she nods. So when the Reds left, he's a valuable hostage, yes, I tell her. If Maven is still alive, Tiberius is vulnerable. Nobles might still be loyal to his brother. Mother surveys me like an advisor, not a daughter. It thrills me, and I feel my spine straighten, flattening my back against my seat as I draw up to my full height. Do you think that's possible? She asks. I chew on the answer for a moment, weighing what I know of Norta and its silvers. I think those silver houses just want a reason not to back Tiberius, to hold on to their country as it was. Both my mother and Tiara, a queen and the queen-to-be, watch me silently. I raise my chin. I say we give them a reason.
29. Mare. It's nightfall when we reach Ascendant, gliding through the mountains in almost pitch darkness. I try not to think about being smashed against the black slopes, but the pilots are skilled, landing our airjet on the Alpine runway with ease. The rest of Montfort's air fleet, as well as the transport convoys carrying the bulk of their army, is down on the plain. They'll have to climb the Hawkway to get to the city, or disperse along other roads and travel routes throughout Montfort to return to their posts. The country will then take up defensive positions, guarding its own borders. On the off chance the Lakelanders decide to try their might against the mountains, or prod the raiders and prairie into doing their work for them. Farley, Davidson, their attendants, and I make the trek into the city in silence, walking the steps beneath an arc of glittering starlight. I watch the sky as we go, trying to name the constellations. I refuse to think about either Kalor brother, not the one we left in Norta, nor the one marching with us, bound in chains, held at gunpoint. He chatters occasionally, asking questions about Montfort. No one answers. And his voice dies slowly, left to echo into nothing. Before we reach the Premier's home, Maven is taken away, down another flight of steps, where more guards appear to flank him. Montfort won't risk losing another prisoner. Maven won't get the gentle treatment given to Bracken's children. He will be taken deep into the city, to the prison below the Ascendant main barracks. I try not to watch his silhouette as it grows smaller and smaller. He never looks back. Farley outpaces everyone, even Killorn and his long strides. I don't have to be a mind reader to guess her thoughts are of her daughter, left behind with the rest of our family. Davidson was good enough to send word on ahead, so his palatial home is ablaze when we approach, the many windows and balconies lit by warm candles and lights. Familiar figures cast shadows across the stones, and we beeline for them. My mother hands off Clara, the baby girl sleepy but smiling, as Farley lifts her up. Out of the corner of my eye, I see Davidson embrace his husband, Carmadon, before my mom does the same to me. Her arms squeeze my shoulders tightly, and she hugs me to her chest with a deep sigh. I relax as I only can with the rest of my family, letting them usher us inside and up to our rooms. The reunion is sentimental as ever, even though it's become a habit. I leave, face death, and against all odds, return in one piece. I know my parents would tie me down to stop me from repeating the cycle, if they thought it might work. But they trust me to make my own choices. And besides, I'm a new blood. The Lightning Girl. There are very few bonds that can hold me back. No matter how much I might want to stay, the need to move on, to keep fighting, is always stronger. Farley disappears into her own bedroom, Clara on her hip, with an exhausted smile. No one stops her. She needs time alone with her daughter, and we're all happy to give it. Instead, my family filters onto the tiled terrace, which is bursting with more flowers than I remember. Tramie has been busy. They're beautiful, I tell him, gesturing to a lovely array of white blooms curling up and over the railing. He heaves himself into a chair with a bashful grin, and Gisa perches on the arm of the seat. I plop down next to them both, content to sit on a flat, squashy cushion set on the tile. "Mom helped," Traimi says, gesturing across to her. At the edge of the terrace, she waves a hand. Her hair is down tonight. I'm used to long years of my mother in twisted braids and neat buns, always keeping her hair out of her face. Despite the gray, she looks younger like this. "I just followed you around with a watering can," she says. I've never considered Ruth Barrow beautiful. How could anyone, let alone a poor red woman, be considered beautiful next to Silver's? But Montfort brings a glow to her, a healthiness in her golden skin that makes it gleam. Even her wrinkles seem lessened, softened by the gentle lamplight. Of course, Dad looks better than ever, hardier than he was in the stilts. He's gained weight where he needs to, arms and legs filling out, while his waist looks trimmer. I chalk it up to nutrition, and of course, his replaced leg and lung. After he greets me, he settles into his usual gruff silence, claiming a seat of his own next to Bree. The weeks have been good to all of them, especially Gisa. Her dark red hair glints like oil in the dim light. I take in her clothing, a repurposed Montfort uniform, but the cuffs and collar are heavily embroidered in swirls of colored thread, pricking out a pattern of flowers and purple-bright zags of lightning. I reach out to her, running my fingers over her careful handiwork. "I can make you one, if you like," she says, eyeing my own uniform. The offensively bright red of the Scarlet Guard outfit makes her wrinkle her nose. "Maybe downplay all this," she mutters, waving her hands a little. "Give you something a little better than medals." Killorn eases himself down next to me, leaning back on his hands with his legs crossed. "Do I get one too?"
"If I feel like it,"
Gisa replies with her usual sniff. She eyes him up and down, as if assessing a customer.
"Fish instead of flowers, I think."
I can't help but chuckle into my hand, grinning at Killorn's exaggerated pout.
"So how long will you be here this time?" My father's voice is still a low grunt, full of accusation.
I glance at him, meeting his dark brown eyes, the same eyes as Bree and Traimi, darker than my own. Mom puts a hand on his shoulder, as if she can push him off the subject.
"Daniel, she just got back."
He doesn't look at her.
"That's my point."
"It's fine," I murmur, glancing between them. It's an honest question, and a good one, especially based on recent circumstances. "To tell you the truth, I don't know. It could be days, could be weeks, could be months." My family seems to brighten with each larger measurement of time. It pains me to give them what could be false hope, even though I want it to be true. "We still don't know how things will proceed." Dad purses his lips.
"With Norta."
I shake my head. "With the Lakelands, mostly." The others look on, silent as I explain, except for Killorn. His brow furrows slowly, creasing his forehead with deep, angry lines. "They hold all the power right now. Cal is still consolidating a torn country, and we're waiting to see how everything shakes out. If the Lakelands strike," my oldest brother draws an angry breath before pushing it out in an exasperated sigh. He glares at me because there's simply no one else to glare at.
"You'll help fight them off?"
As with Dad, I hear an accusation in him. I can only shrug. It isn't me he's frustrated with, but the situation I keep finding myself in. Pulled toward danger, torn between silver kings, a weapon to be wielded, a face to be used. "I don't know," I mutter. "We aren't allied to him anymore." At my side, Killorn shifts, uncomfortable on the tile. Or the subject.
"And what about the other one?"
A Around the cluster of chairs, my family blanches in varying levels of confusion. Mom crosses her arms over her chest, fixing me with a piercing stare I know all too well.
Who?
She asks, even though she knows. She just wants to make me say it. Gritting my teeth, I force an answer.
He means Maven.
My father's voice turns deadly, like I've never heard it before.
He should be dead by now.
He's not, and he's here. Killorn snarls before I can stop him. A pulse of fury thrums through my family. Every face turning red, every lip curling, all eyes sharpening with glints of rage.
Killorn, don't start trouble,
I hiss, squeezing his wrist. But the damage is already done. The silence around our circle runs heavy with scarlet anger, so strong I can almost taste it. Finally, Gisa speaks. Her tone is feral as my father's.
We should kill him.
My sister is not a violent girl, better suited to a needle than a knife. But she looks like she could claw Maven's eyes out if given the opportunity. I would feel guilty for bringing this anger out in her, but I can't get beyond the sudden swell of love, appreciation, and pride. My brothers nod slowly, agreeing with her sentiment. They might even be cooking up some harebrained attempt to get into Maven's cell right now. He's valuable alive, I say quickly, if only to stop them short.
I don't give a shit about his value,
Bree snaps. I expect our mother to scold him for his language, but she isn't bothered by the curse. In fact, she looks positively murderous herself, and for an instant, I see the violent love of Queen Annabelle, Laurentia Viper, and even Elara Mirandis in her eyes.
That creature took my son from me, and he took you.
I'm right here, Mom, I murmur, swallowing around the sudden painful memory of Shade.
You know what I mean, she says. I'll slit his throat myself.
Most shocking of all is Dad's silence. He's a naturally quiet man, but not when it comes to despising Silvers. When I glance at him, I realize why he won't say anything. Because he can't. His face is a furious red, boiling with a steady, rising hatred. If he opens his mouth, who knows what might tumble out.
Can we talk about something else?
I have to ask, looking around at the rest of my family.
Please do.
Dad barely manages through gritted teeth.
You all look well, I say quickly.
His Montfort mom seems annoyed, but dips her head in acceptance. She answers for all of them, cutting me off.
It's a dream, Mare.
My natural suspicion flares, in spite of all I know about Davidson. But I don't know his country or his city. I don't know the politicians he serves or the people they represent.
Is it too good, though?
I ask. Do you think we'll wake up to find ourselves in trouble? To find something gone horribly wrong. She heaves a heavy sigh, looking out at the sparkling lights of Ascendant.
I suppose we should always be wary.
But I don't think so, Dad offers, neatly finishing her thought. His words are few, but expressive.
This place is different.
Gisa nods along with them.
I've never seen reds and silvers together like this. Back in Norta, when I went to cell with my mistress, silvers wouldn't even look at us, wouldn't touch us.
Her brown eyes, the same as mine, glaze a little as she remembers her life as it was so long ago, before a silver officer smashed apart her sewing hand.
Not here.
In his seat, Tremi settles back, some of his ire melting away, like a cat smoothing his fur after a scare.
We feel like equals.
I can't help but wonder if it's because of me, their family to the Lightning Girl, a valuable asset to the Montfort Premier. Of course they'd be treated well. But I don't say any of that out loud, if only to maintain some kind of peace on an otherwise tumultuous night. After that, the conversation becomes far more pleasant. Servants, kindly and smiling, bring up a sizable spread for dinner. The food is simple, but rich and tasty, ranging from fried chicken to sugary dark purple berries spread over toast. The food is mostly for my benefit and Killorn's, but Bree and Traymi help themselves to full portions. Gisa favors a tray of fruits and cheeses, while Dad fixes himself a plate of cold meats and crackers to share with Mom. We eat slowly, talking more than chewing. I mostly listen, letting my siblings regale me with stories of their explorations throughout Ascendant. Bree swims in the lake every morning. Sometimes he wakes up Traymi with it too, dumping a bottle of icy water on his head. Gisa has an almost scientific knowledge of the shops and markets, as well as the grounds of the Premier's compound. She likes to walk the high meadows with Traymi, while Mom prefers the gardens in the city, terraced down the slopes. Dad has been honing his walking abilities, going deeper and deeper into the valley every day, strengthening his new muscles, and relearning two legs with every step down and every step back up. Killorn fills in as well as he can, detailing our exploits since we left Montfort last. It's a sparse recollection, and he is gracious enough to leave out the more embarrassing or upsetting details, including any mention of Cameron Cole. For Gisa's sake, but judging by the way she spoke about a young girl and the jeweler's shop she worked in, I think her old crush on my best friend has passed. Eventually, my eyelids begin to droop. It's been a long, difficult day. I try not to remember how I woke up this morning, in the dark of Cal's royal bedchamber, his blankets over my body. Tonight, I'll sleep in a bed by myself. Not alone, though. Gisa will be just across the room. I still can't sleep without someone else there. Or at least, I haven't tried since I escaped Maven's imprisonment. Don't think about him. I chant it to myself as I prepare for bed, repeating the words over and over. Cal's face seems burned against my eyelids, while Maven haunts even my fleeting, distant dreams. Those stupid boys. They never leave me alone. In the morning, my nerves twitch with energy. It's a constant pull, a tug behind my stomach, like someone has a hook around my spine. I know where it wants me to go. Down into the city, toward the central barracks of Ascendant. The structure squats over the city prison, drilled into the bedrock of the mountainside. I try not to picture him, alone behind bars, pacing like a dying animal. Why I want to see him, I can hardly understand. Maybe some part of me knows he's still useful, or wants to understand him a little more, before time runs out. We're alike in some ways. Too many ways. I've tasted darkness, and he lives in it. He represents what I could become, without my family, without an anchor, if I'm pushed into the abyss. But Maven is the abyss. I can't face him. Not yet. I'm not strong enough to do it. He'll just laugh in my face, taunt and torture, turning the screws embedded too deeply. I need to heal a bit before he can pick open my wounds again. So instead of walking down into the city, I go up, and up, and up. At first I follow the road we took over the mountain when the raiders struck down on the plain. We now know that it was a planned attack, meant to distract us while the Lakelanders rescued Prince Bracken's children. The raiders were paid to do it, and paid well. I kick at stones as I go, replaying the battle in my mind. The silence clawed at my body, like something alive and unnatural beneath my skin, replacing my lightning with emptiness. Cursing, I push the thought away and turn off the road, into the rocks and trees. The hours pass, and the air seems to burn in my lungs, searing down my throat. It's matched only by the fire in my muscles. They scream with each new step, every foot forward and upward over the rocks. Snow puddles in the shadows, white and pure even in the late summer. It turns even colder as I climb, my feet sliding over dirt and pine needles, gravel and naked rock. In spite of the pain, I push on. Streams trickle past, running down the mountainside to pool in the lake far below. I look back through the gaps in the pines, into the valley. The mountains dwarf Ascendant, and the foreign capital looks like a child's toy from this distance. White blocks strewn around ribbon-thin roads and winding stairs. The mountain range seems endless, a jagged wall of stone and snow dividing the world in half. Above, the clear blue sky beckons to me to continue the climb. I do my best, stopping at the streams to drink and splash my red, sweaty face. Occasionally I fish out crackers from my pack, or strips of salted meat. I wonder if the smell might lure a bear or wolf across my path. I have my lightning, of course, close as the breath in my lungs, but no predator ever comes near. I think they know I'm as dangerous as they are. All except for one. At first I mistake him for an outcropping of rock, silhouetted against the perfect blue, still in gray clothing. The pines are sparser at this high altitude, offering little shade from the noon sun. I have to blink, rubbing my eyes, before I realize what I'm looking at. Who I'm looking at. My lightning splits the granite boulder beneath him in two. He moves before it strikes, sliding off into the rocks. You bastard, I snarl, advancing with speed, the adrenaline sudden and surging in my blood. It drives me, as does frustration, because I know, no matter how fast I am, no matter how strong my lightning, I'll never catch him. John will always see me coming. His laughter echoes over the slope, coming from higher up. I snarl to myself and follow the sound, letting him lead me. He laughs and laughs, and I climb and climb. By the time we're out of the trees, over earth, too high for anything to grow, the air has turned harsh and cold. I choke down a gasp of anger, letting the temperature shock my lungs, and I slump, unable to go any farther, unwilling to let John or anyone control where I go and what I do. But mostly, I'm just exhausted. I lean back, bumping against a large boulder, smothered by centuries of unforgiving wind and snow. My breathing comes hard and heavy. I think I might never catch my breath, just as I'll never catch the damned seer. The altitude, his voice says. It makes everything difficult if you aren't used to it. Even your fire prince would have a hard time climbing his first mountain. I'm too tired to do much more than glance at him, eyes half-lidded. He perches above me, legs dangling. John is dressed for the mountain weather, in a thick coat, with well-worn boots on his feet. I wonder how long he's been walking, or how long he had to wait up here for me. You know as well as I do he isn't a prince anymore, I answer, choosing my words very carefully. Maybe I can get him to reveal something, just a sniff of the future ahead of us all. Just like you know how long he'll be a king. Yes, he replies, smirking slightly. Of course he knows what I'm doing, and he says only what he intends to say. I heave another heavy breath, sucking air into my starved lungs. What are you doing here?
Taking in the view.
He still hasn't looked at me, his red eyes trained on the horizon. The sight before us is amazing, more splendid than it was 1,000 feet below. I really do feel small and large, everything and nothing, sitting here on the rim of the world. My breath fogs before my eyes, a testament to the chill. I can't stay long, not if I want to get down before nightfall. I wish I could take John's head with me. I told you this would happen, he murmurs. Snarling, I bare my teeth at him. You didn't tell me anything. My brother might be alive if you did. Thousands of people. Have you considered the alternative? He snaps. That what I did, what I said and didn't say, did and didn't do, saved more? I ball a fist and kick my foot, sending a shower of gravel skittering down the slope. Have you considered just keeping your nose out of everything? John barks a laugh.
Many times. But whether I involve myself or not, I see the path. I see the destination. And sometimes I just can't let it happen.
So nice you get to decide, I sneer, bitter as I always am with the wretched new blood.
Would you like the burden, Mayor Barrow? John replies, lowering himself down so he sits side by side. He smiles sadly. I didn't think so. I shudder beneath his crimson attention. You told me I would rise and rise alone, I mutter, repeating the words he spoke so long ago, in an abandoned coal town half-shrouded by the rain. That was my fate, and I've watched it become truer with every passing day, when I lost Shade, when I lost Cal, but also in the steady detachment, the cold hand that seems to worm itself between me and everyone else I love. No matter how hard I try to ignore it, I can't help but feel different, broken and angry, and therefore alone, with only one person left who truly understands. And he is a monster. I lost Maven, too, the person he pretended to be, the friend I loved and needed when I was so alone and so afraid. I've lost so many people. But I've gained many. Farley, Clara, my family is still with me, safe but for Shade. Killorn, never wavering in his loyalty and friendship. I have the Electricons, new bloods like me, who prove I am not alone. Premier Davidson, and all he hopes to do. They outnumber everyone I've lost. I don't think you were right, I mumble, half believing the words. Next to me, John jolts, his neck cracking as he looks at me sharply. Or has that path changed, too? Even though I hate his eyes, I force myself to stare into them, to look for a lie or the truth. Did I change it? He blinks slowly. You changed nothing. I feel like elbowing him in the throat, or the gut, or the skull. Instead, I slump backward, tipping my head to glare at the sky. John watches, chuckling a little. What? I snarl, eyeing him. Rise, he murmurs, pointing to the valley, thousands of feet below. Then he points to my chest. And rise alone. This time I bat his arm weakly, wishing I could inflict more hurt on the seer. I know you weren't talking about climbing a mountain, I growl. No longer the lightning but the storm. The storm that will swallow the world entire. He just rolls his shoulders and looks out to the range again, his breath steaming in the cold air. Who knows what I was talking about? You do. And I'll keep that weight to myself, thank you very much. No one else needs it. I scoff. You act as if you enjoy lording our fates over us. Chewing my lip, I weigh my chances again. A hint from him could be infinitely valuable or damning, throwing me onto a path of his choosing. I simply have to take the chance and consider what he says with a mountain of salt. Any more choice words, little nudges, you might condescend to give? The corner of his mouth lifts, but his eyes waver, almost sad. Your friend is better at fishing than you. Cold air whistles down my throat as I inhale sharply. What do you know about Killorn? I ask, my voice climbing an octave. Killorn is no one to John, no one to grand movements of kingdoms and fate. He shouldn't take up an inch of space in John's head, not in comparison to the thousands of dangerous and horrible things he does keep in there. I move to grab his arm, but he shifts neatly from my touch. His red eyes stare, like twin drops of blood. He's the catalyst for all this, isn't he? For your part in it, at least. He says, the poor friend doomed to conscription, with only you to save him. John's words are slow, methodic, deliberate, giving me time to put together the pieces of this part of the puzzle. I try not to know, try not to accept what is staring me in the face. I want to kill him, smash his head against the rock, but I can't move. Because he lost his apprenticeship, I say, trembling. Because Killorn's master died. Because Killorn's master fell.
It isn't a question. John knows exactly what happened to old Cully, the fisherman my best friend used to serve. A simple man, gray before his years, just like the rest of us. Tears fill my eyes. I've been a puppet for too long. Even longer than I thought possible.
You pushed him.
I push many people, in many different ways.
Did you push an innocent man to his death?
I seethe. Something switches in him, like a lamp turning off or on, shifting his focus. He gathers himself and sniffs, his voice suddenly clear, more forceful, as if he is addressing a crowd of soldiers, rather than just me.
The Lakelands will strike Archeon soon, he says. Within a few weeks, they're preparing as we speak, drilling their armies past the point of perfection. Tiberius Calor is weak, and they know it.
I don't have the heart or stomach to argue. He's right, and I'm still reeling.
If they take the city, Tiberius will never win Norta. Not this year, not the next, not even 100 years from now.
I clench my teeth. You could be lying. He ignores me, forging on.
If the capital falls to the Queen of the Lakelands, the road becomes long and bloody, worse than anything you've experienced before.
In his lap, he knits his fingers together, knuckles going white against the gray of his clothes.
Even I can barely see the ending of that path. But I know it's terrible.
I don't like being your chess piece.
Everyone is someone else's pawn, Mare, whether we know it or not.
Whose pawn are you?
He doesn't respond, only raising his eyes to the clear, cold sky. With a final sigh, he pushes himself to his feet, dislodging rocks with the motion.
You should get moving, he says, gesturing down the mountain.
So I can pass on your message? I snap, sounding bitter. Taking John's orders is the last thing I want to do right now, even if he's right. I think I'd rather freeze than give him the satisfaction.
So you can avoid that, he replies.
With his chin, he points off to the north, where a band of clouds gathers across the peaks.
Storms move quickly up here.
I can handle storms.
Do as you wish,
John replies, shrugging. He pulls his coat tighter around himself.
We will not see each other again, Mare Barrow.
Still on the ground, I sneer up at him.
Good.
He doesn't respond and turns around to continue his climb. I watch his figure grow smaller, a gray man against gray stone, until he disappears. To rise and rise alone. The storm breaks on the summit as soon as I step into the protection of the tree line, escaping a howl of wind and freezing rain. It hurts almost as much as going up, my knees jarring with the hard impact of every step. I have to be careful and focus on where I put my feet, lest I break an ankle on the loose stones and pine needles piled over the trail. Above me, back up the mountain, a low thrum of thunder peals, alive as my own beating heart. I reach ascendant as the sun first sinks beneath the peaks across the valley. Even though I'm sore from the climb and aching from the conversation, my pace quickens as I enter the Premier's palace. I pass Montfort's soldiers and officers, as well as politicians from his government, marked by their fine suits, all milling around the lower level of the building, leaving meetings or going to them. They watch me pass with scrutiny, but not fear. I'm not a freak here. Two heads of shocking hair, one blue, one bone white, stand out in the crowd of dark green suits and uniforms, Ella and Titan. My fellow Electricons idle in one of the windowed alcoves, taking up enough space that they can be left alone. Waiting for me? You shouldn't have, I say with a smile, my breath still uneven and ragged from the climb. Titan looks me up and down, a lock of white hair falling into his face. He leans back calmly, one long leg planted against the seat across.